What's up, Mercy Hill Online? We're excited to be diving into a brand new book of the Bible this weekend. Hey, if you are new with us, it's a great time to be new because we're all going to be new together. Man, a lot of things kicking off this fall. Our groups are just starting back. Man, we're having new services come online all the time. And yes, we got a brand new series today. So if you are new, you picked a great time to come by our channel. Listen, if you are new, we want you to text MH Church to 41411. We have a gift card that we would love to send to you. We'd love to hear how you heard about Mercy Hill and help you connect. Man, at Mercy Hill, we believe that every person, inside of every person, y'all, there is a gift, a call, and a destiny that is waiting to be activated, all right? God has a place for you in his mission. He's got something he wants to do with your story, and we would love to kind of help you in that process and help you get there, all right? So please do that, text that, and we would love to connect with you. All right, we're going to dive in today in Ruth chapter 1, all right? The game plan over the next couple of months, actually, is to be diving into this incredible book in the Bible. Ruth is a true heroine, and what I want to do is kind of pull out some things about her life. I want to pull out some things that we can kind of model an example. I want to look at some of the morality that comes out of this book, but y'all, even more than that, what we want to see over the next couple of months is this idea that God sovereignly works to redeem a people from all nations, all right? What we're going to end up seeing is that just like God to make the point about, you know, his kingdom and what he's trying to do in the world, isn't it just like God to make the point that his kingdom is about all nations by using all nations to bring about Jesus Christ, our true king? And that's what we're going to end up seeing. Y'all, Ruth has a tough story. She's got a lot of suffering in her story, but what we're going to end up seeing is that without Ruth, we don't get to David, and without David, we don't get to Jesus. Man, it's all part of what God is doing, sovereignly building this out. That's what we're going to do over the whole series, but for today, we're going to dive into Ruth chapter 1, and here's what we're going to end up seeing. Big idea for the sermon, all right? God builds families through promises, and so should we, all right? God builds families through promises, and so should we. I think that, you know, right off the bat, as I begin to talk about families, I know that we could end up sort of losing maybe half our church, all right? Half our church is single, especially when you count all the kids we got around here, okay? So there's a lot of single people in our church, single again people in our church, and I start talking about family, immediately we start thinking about marriage. Y'all, this is all about family, and this particular sermon is almost nothing about marriage. Okay. Yes, the story of Ruth is God's great love story in the Bible, but this story is about a mother and a daughter becoming family, not by blood, but through promise. And that's what I want to talk to you guys about today. The world builds relationships on such a foundation that is shaky, on such a shaky and fragile foundation. We build relationships through things like blood, and we think blood is thicker than water, but then we realize when a patriarch or matriarch in a family is finally is gone, all of a sudden the kids are squabbling and fighting and they tear their family apart over an inheritance, but blood is supposed to be thicker than water. It's heartbreaking. It's a fragile foundation is what I want you to see. Man, we start thinking about things like feelings. Feelings are the foundation for our relationships, and our family should be built on feelings. But the problem is that feelings fade. I know that some of us might be in relationships where you're newly married. Some of you have a sweet little child at home, and you think, how in the world can my feelings ever fade? You just wait. You get your nose out of the Nicholas Sparks books, and you realize, like, man, things ebb and flow. When you begin to think about navigating kids and mortgage and vocation and all of that, man, the love is there. But you think of the honeymoon period, people say that honeymoon phase, they say that for a reason. Same thing with kids. We had one of our kids, one of our residents the other day walked out and saw one of our pastor's kids running by, real cute little kid. He's like, man, I got to get me one of those, okay? And our pastor said to the resident, he said, hey, let me come drop him off at your house for a week and then we'll see how you feel. It's not that you don't love your kids any less or whatever, but hey, if your foundation is feeling, what are you going to do when those feelings begin to fade, all right? Man, if your foundation is on something like compatibility and convenience, this happens to our college students all the time, compatibility and convenience. Man, when we're on the campus together, when we're right down the dorm room hall, but what happens after that? What happens when that compatibility or convenience is gone? This is shaky foundation for a relationship. Blood, feelings, convenience. The gospel has something so much bigger for us, all right? The Bible presents another way, and that other way is supposed to be lived out in the church, y'all. It's supposed to be lived out in a way that shines into the culture, where the church actually is able to put on display something that is better than all these shaky foundations. And y'all, that is the promise, all right? The idea of covenantal love, the idea that we look and we don't say to people, hey, I'm with you if I can gain something from you. We don't commoditize people. It's not about a consumer. It's a covenantal love. It's a promise we end up saying to people, hey, me for you, not demanding you for me. When we begin to do that, we'll begin to commit to one another. And I want to show you that in Ruth chapter 1. Look at this story. Here we go, verse 6. I'm going to have to fill in a lot of gaps here. I'm going to be talking fast, but let's dive in. She arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant you that you may find rest, each of you in the house of her husband. Then she kissed them and they lifted up their voices and wept. Let me fill in some cracks for you guys, all right? Tragedy has befallen this group of women. This is a group of women that's living in the time of the judges, maybe 1000 BC or something like that. There was a dude named Elimelech and his wife Naomi, and they had two sons. There was a famine in the land. Actually, they're from Bethlehem, of all places, okay? So we're already starting to see some of the foreshadowing here. But there's a famine in the land. They end up deciding that it's time for them to move. They move to the land of Moab, which is actually enemy territory, but they start setting up a life. And the boys actually get married in Moab. And man, I could just see Elimelech and Naomi sitting on the front porch. They're just, man, all they need now, I mean, their life is full. They're working, their boys are married. All they're waiting on now is the grants to come along, okay? And all of a sudden, tragedy strikes, and Elimelech dies, and the two boys die, and all of a sudden, Naomi goes from full, in terms of family, to now totally devastated. I mean, in the ancient world, family was everything. You know, the ancient world, family was your safety net. Family was your security, especially for a woman in this time. I mean, you think about Naomi. I mean, every culture has a culture. You know, every culture has things that they value. Our culture values individual accomplishment and achievement. Man, this culture then, it valued family more than the individual. All of a sudden, Naomi, everything has been stripped. There's no family. There's no protection. There's no safety net. Historically, this is a very vulnerable time for women in a situation like this. There's no income. And worse for Naomi, one author said it like this. It's like the worst kind of widowhood in that day because she has no prospects. She's too old to build a new family. And so verse 7, man, they're just in a bad state of affairs. She set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, remember? And she says, let's go, let's return. But as they're on their way, Naomi ends up stopping and she looks at the girls and she says, no, wait, you guys return to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you. Actually, that's a very deep word in the old languages here. May he be compassionate, mercy, grace. May all these things follow you. The Lord grant you that you may find rest in the house of your husband. Y'all, this is so interesting. I had actually, man, I've studied this book before. I've preached this book before. I've read it many times. Something occurred to me that's never occurred to me before in this book, and that is that she doesn't tell them to go back to their house until they're on their way back to her house. Now, that's interesting to me. I don't know if you guys have ever thought about this, but when you think about Naomi, what's actually going on is that she has already made the decision, hey, they're all going to come back with me. We're all going to go together. Why? Because Naomi is wise in a sense. She understands that two are better than one. She understands the Ecclesiastes passage that we talked about a few weeks ago. She understands, I'm old. It's better for me if these young women come with me. They're committed to go with me because of the marriage to my sons and all of that. It's better for me. They can glean in the field, all of that stuff. But she begins to think in her mind, wait a minute, I love these girls, Orpah and Ruth. I love them. And even though it's better for me that they go with me, it might be better for them that they just go back to their, I'm their mother now, but their actual mother's household. Maybe it would be better that they go back. Why? Because they could find refuge in another marriage. We may not like this. It may offend our modern sensibilities. But the fact is, Naomi was thinking in her mind, rest. And that's a huge biblical theme, right? Rest from the brokenness of the world was found in a good man's house. In that time, it would be found when you had the safety and security of a what the book of Ruth calls a worthy man's house. And I think about that. I think about that for all of us because you know what the truth is, y'all, for every one of us, men and women alike, soul rest is really only found in the house of one man. And that's when Jesus Christ spreads his wings over us. But we're going to get all the way into that as we go through the course of this series. Man, she looks at Orpah and she looks at Ruth. Man, they're just devastated. They're crying. You know, they don't really know what to do. They say, no, we will return with you to your people. And Naomi says, no, turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Yet have I yet sons in the womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way. I'm too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they are grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter for me, for your sake, that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. Then they lifted up their voices, they wept again. Listen, this is important. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her mother. This is getting very deep, very fast, okay? Now, what's going on? Especially if you're newer to the Bible, man, you've come to the right place. So this is a great story. We're going to try to break it all the way down. If you're newer to the Bible, you're like, man, what is going on here with Naomi? And I'm going to have new sons, and then you guys are going to wait to marry them, or just kind of like whatever it is. And what you got to understand here is that there's a concept that God built in to his people's law in Deuteronomy chapter 25 that was for the well-being of vulnerable women. Okay, now we can say today, this is offensive to me that women were in a vulnerable situation without a man a couple thousand years ago or whatever. We could say that offends me. I don't like that. I don't like that a woman's, you know, standing was all wrapped up with a man and all that kind of stuff. We can say that we don't like that, and that's fine. There's things that rub me wrong about that, but saying that we're offended by it doesn't take away the fact that that's the way that it was. And I think that we also can get pretty high on the horse here, because I bet you 3,000 years ago, the fact that we live in a culture of abortion and mass incarceration would have offended them. All right, so we can't just get on a high horse here and all of a sudden look back. But what we realize is that God had baked something into his law. Things like this in the Bible get misconstrued. They get taken out of context. I'm telling you that in a world that was dominated by men and was offensive, and not offensive, oppressive toward women of the day, it was a good thing that if a man died, that a woman had the right to demand, really, that his brother would marry her and raise a son to the dead man, and that she would be taken into somebody's house. Did she have to go? No, she didn't have to go. But if he refused to take her on, she could publicly shame him before the elders, and everybody in the city would know, this is a guy who ain't even worth his salt. He's not worthy to raise up and to take in those in his family because his brother died. This is God's goodness. We don't read it that way, but that's what it is. It's a safety net for vulnerable people. God always has these things built in, baked into his law. We should think about them more. Naomi says, I can't have sons now. You can't wait for them. What she's saying is, rest is found in the house of a man, but you're not going to be able to wait for my sons or whatever to be grown up in the Levirate marriage tradition. And so finally, what Orpah kind of comes to the realization of is, man, going back with Naomi is going to be bitter for me. I'm going to be a foreigner. I'm going to be a woman. I'm going to be a widow in a land that I don't know, that is racially charged like we can't even imagine. And so Orpah, and I'm not throwing rocks, okay, but this is just what happens. Orpah decides, you know what, it is better for me to go back. I bet she even felt the same way that Ruth felt, and that is that, hey, Naomi is doing a selfless thing here by telling us to go back, but even though it's selfless, it doesn't change Orpah's heart. What Orpah decides is, you know what, I will go back, and in making her decision, y'all, she walked right out of the pages of the Bible. I think there's a concept here that I want to get into for just a minute, and that is this. Listen, Orpah was in a bad state of affairs. You want to talk about oppression? Orpah was oppressed. You want to talk about tragedy? Orpah was in tragedy. You want to talk about bad circumstances, broken past? This is what is going on in Orpah's life, and yet it is on her to take the responsibility to choose wisdom if she don't do it. You know, the culture wants us to line up on one side or the other, doesn't it? Our culture always wants to do this. It wants to say there's oppression on one side or responsibility on the other, while the Bible talks about both all the time, intertwined. Sometimes you can't even break them apart. Y'all, oppression doesn't take away responsibility any more than responsibility takes away the reality of oppression. Our culture says on one side, because of tragedy, oppressive circumstances, and brokenness, individuals are off the hook for their choices. The other side says individual responsibility reigns supreme. Don't talk to me about oppression. And then you have the Bible that shows us examples like this. There is brokenness. We can all understand. We should have empathy for Orpah. And at the same time, she made the wrong call. At the same time, there is a responsibility here. The same Bible, the book of wisdom, tells us on one hand, those who seek the Lord find life. Those who hate him, Proverbs 8, find death. And at the same time, Proverbs 11:1 says, God hates the weighted scale that is imbalanced, that's cheating, that's an oppressive system, that's a society that holds people down. We can have both. We should be able to speak to both. We don't have to fall off one side or the other. Church, I've told you, we don't line up. We rub both sides the wrong way. Orpah was the definition of oppressed, and she was unwise. She did both of those things. Ruth was the definition of oppressed, and yet she chose the wise path here, even though it was hard. And that's what we see when it says that Ruth clung to Naomi. Look at verse 14. Ruth clung to Naomi and she said, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, and you guys know this passage. If you've ever been, you know, to a wedding, you know this passage already. "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts me from you." And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. What is Ruth saying here? Y'all, Ruth is like, man, I ain't having it, okay? You can keep on with this, and you can kind of keep trying to push me away, but the reality is that probably through the teaching of not only Elimelech and Naomi and the brothers and all of that, I have come to an understanding of the Lord. I have come to an understanding of his loving kindness. I have seen it even in you, Naomi, that you would be willing to selflessly say, even though it's better for you that I come, you're telling me to stay because that's better for me. There's only one God on the face of the planet that teaches things like that, I think she would say at that time. Not you for me, but me for you. And there is something in Ruth that is awakened. And she's like, you look at it, I mean, look at the past. She's like, man, I ain't having it. Don't talk to me about it no more. This is what's going on. I'm going to make a promise to you. I'm going to make a covenant to you. I'm going to bind myself to you. I mean, what does she actually say? Lodging, staying. She ends up saying, I will be buried where you're buried. Y'all, that's bold, okay? I mean, to go to somebody and to say to them, hey, I'm going to be in the burial plot with your family next to you. That's where I want to be. That's what she says. She is making a promise. That's what she is doing here. And I want to make sure that we understand, y'all, this is an outstanding commitment. This is something that is just beautiful. And the question is, hey, what is the trigger that brings about such a commitment like this? And this is where it gets so radically deep. We think about Old Testament stories as if they're divorced from the New Testament narrative. It's not. There's so much typology all the time. Think about what goes on in this passage. The outstanding commitment of Ruth comes, the promise, the commitment, the covenant love from Ruth. It comes in response to the sacrificial love of Naomi. You know, and that's what happens here. Sacrificial love creates an overwhelming response. You guys know Ruth ain't the main character of Ruth. You know who is? Everybody's expecting me to say God. Well, he is kind of the whole Bible, okay? Naomi is. The story starts with Naomi. It ends with Naomi, actually. It starts with her. It talks about the tragedy. It ends with her being full. We're going to get to that. But what we see first right here in this passage is that Naomi's selfless love triggers something. It is the God that has been taught to Ruth that is triggering something in her to say, I will not go back to my gods and to that way of life. I will come with you. Sacrificial love creates this type of response. Naomi is willing to say, it is better for me that you come. It is better for you that you stay. And this is just, y'all, this is just true. Why is that? Well, think about Ruth. I mean, 3,000 years ago, the vulnerability of a widow, a foreigner, not just a widow and a foreigner. Y'all, she is a Moabite, okay? I want you to think about what that means. It means that she is not just otherly in Israel. When they go back to Bethlehem, she won't just be somebody that's like, oh, she's a foreigner. It's like, no, she is an enemy. I mean, she was one that has come down the line of Lot. Incestuous relationship is how Moab even became a nation. The debauchery in the wilderness, the whole debacle of Balaam, all of that is wrapped up in Moab. So much so that twice in this book, Ruth is told, you better stick close to this dude named Boaz because he has kind of taken a liking to you. He's sort of shined upon you. You better stay near to him. Why? Because if you go to somebody else's field, you'll be abused. You'll be harassed. If you go to somebody else's field, violence will come to you, death, maybe something even worse. And what they end up having to tell Ruth during this is like, man, this is what's in Naomi's mind. She knows it's better for her to go back. She knows it's better in Naomi's world. Hey, you come with me, you can work all that. Two is better than one. But she's thinking, I don't want you to be abused. I don't want you to be harmed. I don't want you to face everything that's gonna come with your background and being a Moabite and all of that stuff. So you go back. And Ruth is so moved by Naomi's love that she says, no, I will stay. I will be committed to you in the way that you are committed to me. She commits to Naomi because Naomi has committed to her. Now I wanna ask you this. Hey, what does that sound like to you? I mean, what other story does that sound like? Well, let me try to fast forward a little bit throughout just the Bible here. You know, about 1,000 years later, a child is gonna be born to Naomi and Ruth. A child is going to come that actually is in their lineage. And this child is going to take this concept of, no, not demanding you for me, but me for you. This child is going to take that all the way to the grave. Jesus Christ, the Son of God, stepped into humanity's shoes in order to set us free from the penalty of our sin. Listen, I want you to think about this with me. Jesus Christ, of all people, knows what it's like to be sitting in heaven and say, man, it's better for me to stay. You know, it's better for me to stay, but it's better for you that I come, because I see the path that you're going down. And the path that you're going down is leading to abuse. It's gonna lead to harassment. It's gonna lead ultimately to separation for all eternity. So how about this? How about not me? How about not you for me? How about me for you? And Jesus Christ came, and he was the one that was abused. He was the one that was harassed. He was the one that was ultimately harmed. Even though it was better for Jesus to stay, y'all, he came and he died on the cross to provide us an opportunity to come into the family of God once again. The rest that is talked about in this book, that we are provided that because of what Jesus Christ has done for us. Man, this is the secret to this passage. It's the secret to our relationship with God. It's the secret to our relationship with each other, and it's this. Sacrificial love becomes codified in covenant faithfulness. That when sacrificial love is happening, people respond with covenant promise. People respond. When God has lavished his love upon us, when he lavishes his covenant upon us, when he comes to us and he says, you will be my people and I will be your God, despite our sin, because of what Christ has done on the cross, then all of a sudden we become the type of people, just like Ruth, that will cleave to him. That's what happened. You know, the Bible says that Ruth clung to Naomi. What does that come from? It comes from Genesis chapter 2. What Ruth is saying is, Naomi, you have sacrificed for me. I will cleave to you. I will grab you. I will be one, in a sense, with you. We will be family. Y'all, when we see that Jesus Christ came to lay his life down for us, we will say, I will lay my life down for you. That's what we do in baptism. When we see that Jesus came, we'll say, man, I'll go wherever you go. I will lay wherever you lay. I will be buried wherever you bury, knowing there's a resurrection on the other side. I will go all the way for you because you went all the way for me. So we see in this passage, y'all, that's what Jesus Christ has come to enable every single one of us to do, all right? And we start thinking about building families. This informs the way that we build family. Let me give you a big application for this weekend. Build your family and church. Build your family and your church family through the promise, all right? Listen, there are me-centered ways to build a family. And I want you to think more about gospel-centered ways to build a family. I want you to think about the way that Naomi and Ruth built a family. There are me-centered ways to build families. And when we do that, the evidence of their inadequacy abounds. When we try to build family and it's based on feelings, all right? We teach people, hey, your feelings are the great arbiter. Your feelings are the way that we build family. Chase your feelings. Then we can't understand a culture that thrives, it seems, on divorce. We can't understand a culture where fatherlessness kind of abounds. We've taught people their feelings are the ultimate end. Man, we've built fragile foundations by teaching people that relationships is about consumerism, and then we're shocked when we see bullying and loneliness and the kids that aren't so cool get pushed to the side. That happens all the way through life. We've built the wrong foundation. We say blood is thicker than water, and yet our culture is so radically turned toward the individual instead of the extended family. I read an article by David Brooks on this, especially among the majority culture in our nation. What you end up having is, over the last 100 years, people have been further and further and further and further and further marginalized from their extended families. When we say family now, we mean mom, dad, two kids, and a dog. That's what we mean. Historically, that's never what the word family has meant. Historically, what the word family means is all of it, everybody. That you're not disconnected from all of these different relationships that God intends in your life. And yet, we say blood is thicker than water, and yet we abandon those that are older. We move away and don't even speak to some in our blood families. Y'all, these are fragile foundations. And I would just say this today. If we build relationships on fragile foundations, we should not be shocked when they begin to crumble under that much stress. Enter the gospel. It's not about feelings. It's about promise. It's not about convenience and compatibility. It's about covenant. It's not really even about biology. Okay, it's about theology. It's about what Jesus did for us, that we begin to see, wait a minute, he entered in. Now, there's way more to this that we could talk about. I mean, the blood of Christ actually creates a new family. And I mean, if he's our father, we're all brothers and sisters. I get all that. But I'm just saying, look at the example that Jesus came for us. It wasn't about feelings and biology and all these things that our culture submits. Instead, it was about something different. It was about a promise. I see something in you. I commit myself to you. And when we're willing to do that, y'all, we end up seeing relationships thrive the way that they should. Here's what I want to do. I want to talk to unbelievers, and then I want to talk to the believers, and then we'll be done for this weekend, all right? Let me talk to those of you who are not believers yet. Hey, if you've never stepped over that line, my thing for you today will be this. Don't wait. Look at what Jesus did to build a relationship with you. Look at what he has done to build this relationship. I want you to think about the choice that Orpah and Ruth had together. You can go, and you can go back to what you know, or you can begin to cling to those things that you have seen in selfless love, seen from the God of Abraham. You know, I think about it like this. Ruth is actually, if you saw this, you know, Ruth and her little speech that we do at weddings, nobody realizes it's about making a family between a mom and a daughter, okay? But if you saw her in her speech, what does she say? She said, your people will be my people, your God will be my God. You realize what she's saying. You understand that language and where it comes from. That's why I can so confidently say, like, man, this girl has heard some theology through her people. What she is saying back to Naomi is what God has been saying to her through Naomi. Through Naomi's selflessness. Maybe through Naomi's actual teaching. I don't know. But what Ruth is saying to Naomi is the same thing that God says to Ruth through Naomi and God says to all the nations, which is, I want to be your God and you can be my people. And we see that throughout all of the Bible. Man, this is God's call to humanity. Genesis 17, Exodus 6, Jeremiah 31, Zechariah 8, Revelation 21, over and over and over. What does God say? You will be my people and I will be your God. And Ruth has got some of that. She has caught some of that. Hey, will you catch some of that today? Something about the selfless love and teaching that she got from Naomi, it triggered that willingness in her to step over that line. Hey, would you see the selfless love of Jesus Christ to leave the comfort of heaven and take the poverty of earth in order to bring you into his family? He didn't say you for me. He said me for you. It was easier for him to stay, but he came. Could you see that today? And what it would trigger in you, the reaction that Ruth had, the call to be part of God's people is open to anybody who would take their place in God's people, all right? Hey, if you're not a believer, come today. But if you are a believer, man, I've thought about this. I could go through application after application after application for your marriage, all right? For people that are single and you're thinking about, man, how do I fit into a church that's got older people in it? All right, for people that, the way you interact with your kids. I mean, I could go through all of these applications, but I've got to kind of pare them down, okay? I think you could pare all of them down just by saying this. Look at what Naomi does. Look at what Ruth does. Look at their eventual son 1,000 years later, Jesus Christ does. And can we as believers say, man, as Jesus has been to me, I want to be to somebody else. And therefore, I want to live a life where my relational lens is not biology, it's not feelings, it's not convenience, it's not capability or compatibility. No, my lens is going to be me for you, not demanding you for me. You know, can we do that through marriage? Can we think about that the way that we parent? Can we think about that in the way that we have relationships with our extended family? Hey, can we think about that in the way that we build families? Of course, you guys know I'm going to mention adoption today. I mean, think about this. If Ruth can choose Naomi as a mother, we can certainly choose the vulnerable as sons and daughters. You guys know the heartbeat of one of our ministries here at Mercy Hill is that God builds families. And he can, you know, the way he builds families is through adoption spiritually, and we can model that through adoption and foster care ministries, all right? You know, I think about this for Mercy Hill. Man, many times we may not be the loudest voice on a social issue in terms of social media, but we are going to have the ethic that says, man, if we're going to talk about it, we're going to be about it. And that's what we have done. That's what you have done. And I praise God for this earlier in the year. You guys remember this? Man, you raised over $200,000. Almost $250,000 was raised in order that we could model our love for life in helping God restore families through foster care and build families through adoption. Not screaming about it through slogans, actually going through the suffering and laying it on the line. And you guys did that. You stepped up. And you know what's happened over the last 6 months? 24 new families have either completed the foster classes and been licensed, or they have entered formally into the adoption process of that money that was given. Now that money's gonna, you know, we wanna see 200 families raised up. So we're over the next few years, right? But over that money, over $16,000 has already been given away this year with another 20,000 committed by the end of the year in terms of the people that are entering into these processes right now. Y'all, it's unbelievable what God has done. And I wanna call you to this. Man, listen, some of you that are younger families, I want you to hear what the church has done. Maybe some of you are even brand new. If that's where you are today, many young families think the financial burden of an adoption that's going to be $20,000 or $30,000 or even $40,000 is just too much. I can't do that. What I want you to hear is that you have a church family that has gone before you. I want you to hear that you have a church family that is already committed to you. You understand today that our church came together and said, man, we have this goal of seeing 200 families. When you break that down by adoptions, this is generally what happens. If you're a Mercy Hill member, if you're a Mercy Hill community group and you step forward to adopt, the day you step forward, between 10 and 20% of that bill has already been paid. Now, you can step off the sideline now. And you can get in the race, and we pray that you will. Man, if Ruth can choose Naomi as a mother, we can choose the vulnerable as sons and daughters. Y'all, the last application I'll make in this, because it could be so wide, is just thinking about our relationships in the church with each other and thinking about regroup and all of that. I don't want to send a mixed message here, okay, because I'm scared there might be some people that are like, man, you told me group is like, it might take a few times to find my right group, and it's only a 10-week thing, and I'm not, you know, it's not more of a commitment than that, and now you're telling me I got to go and declare my undying love for my group and tell them I'm going to be buried where they're buried, okay? That's not exactly what we're trying to get across today, but what I am saying, all right, is this idea of covenant lens and promise before feeling and biology and compatibility and all this stuff, man, we can model that. Y'all, we can model that in our student ministry when our students don't just click up together, but they realize, man, there are some people that are down and out. There are some people that don't have people that go to our school. They might be in a different environment. I'm the father of a child with special needs. You think I don't pray that there'll be some Naomi and Ruth kind of things that happen in her life where somebody says, man, it ain't gotta be you for me. It'll be me for you. You know, that's what I'm talking about. Man, we can be that person who says, I'm not demanding that I get something from you, but I'll be something for you. You know, I think you could think about it like this. Y'all, natural family relationships provide the model for relationships within the church. Fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters. I guarantee you there are some Ruths walking around our church right now, and they need a Naomi and a selfless act of love. And you know what? There are some Naomis walking around that could really be energized by a Ruth relationship. Same thing with Paul, with Timothy. We have brothers and sisters. Y'all, how can we begin to view each other through these lenses instead of what we can get from each other, all right? The gospel informs our relationships. On that foundation, they will be stronger, okay? Hey guys, normally I pray right here, but what I'm gonna do is actually make a quick transition. I wanna talk to you guys for just a minute about something that's coming up called the Tithing Project. I'm actually gonna set this up. Pastor Bobby is gonna be doing a very quick 3 or 4 minute teaching on this. You guys know at Mercy Hill that generosity fuels the mission. And we're really gonna go, honestly, about as far as the generosity of the church takes us. That's just kind of the way that it works. And so when we begin to think about generosity and all of that, you know, I've got it in my heart and in my mind, I don't wanna just tell you guys to give. I want to teach you how to tithe. I want to teach you to be all the way obedient. And what God wants for you in that, man, we don't want something from you. We want something for you. Man, we want something for the mission of God. We want something for your personal development and your growth. And we're going to talk about what that is over the next 4 weeks in these little 3 or 4 minute clips. You guys check it out.
Hey church, Pastor Bobby here. As you heard from Pastor Andrew, we will be spending the next 4 weeks teaching about the concept of tithing and call our church to obedience in the area of money. We're calling this the Tithing Project. Tithing is God's blueprint for how we should handle money and possessions. The Tithing Project will show us what the Bible says about giving and teach us principles to help us know how to handle money by God's design. Right from the start, I want to address a few groups of people. First, if you've been faithfully tithing to Mercy Hill, thank you so much. In fact, there are about 170 families that have been consistently giving from the very early days of Mercy Hill. We can't always measure generosity or tithing, but we can measure faithfulness. Second, we know that these are crazy, unprecedented times, and many of us have been impacted, so we're never gonna ask you to give what you don't have. Finally, there are some of you that are uncomfortable with the thought of talking about money in church, and I get that. Maybe that's because of some past hurt or some other reason. I want you to hear our heart. We don't always talk about money at Mercy Hill, but the Bible is not silent about money. And so we feel that it's really important to teach everything the Bible teaches about money and possessions and generosity. Today in week one of the Tithing Project, I want to simply answer this question. What is the tithe? When the Bible uses the word tithe, that simply means giving the first 10% of your income, what God has given to you, back to God. If you'll grab your Bible, I'd like to show you one passage that helps us understand the tithe. Let's look at Genesis 28, verse 20 to 22. Then Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God and this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give a full tenth to you. In this passage, we see Jacob responding in thanksgiving to God by offering a tenth, offering a tithe back to the Lord. This isn't the first time we see humanity offering a tithe to God. In fact, God baked tithing into the human existence from the very beginning. We could see some of the very first characters in the Bible, Cain and Abel, giving back to God what God gave to them. And just a few chapters later in Genesis, we see Abraham offering a tithe to God. There's so much that we could teach about, but the one thing I'll point out that these gifts and tithes all happened before the law. Don't miss this fact, because sometimes we're too quick to dismiss the Old Testament principles and practices simply because they're from the Old Testament law. But the principle of tithing and the fact that it shows up in the Bible before the law points us to the idea that God has baked into design for humanity the concept of the tithe. In fact, God created the tithe to help his people think and act in the right way towards money and possessions. So what is the tithe? The tithe is simply giving back to God 10% of what God has given to us. In giving God 10%, we are declaring with our money and our possessions that we believe that's all God's in the first place. And God wants us to use our money and possessions to fuel his mission. As we talked about today in the sermon, God uses the tithe throughout the Bible to fund the mission to care for the widow, the orphan, and the sojourner. We don't have the time to cover today all the Old Testament passages that discuss the tithe, but if you want to dive deeper this week, I'd encourage you to check out a blog that we're going to post this week. These priorities have never changed. The church still advances through the generosity of God's people, and we're still called to care for the widow, the orphan, and the sojourner. Next week, we're going to learn more about how the sacrifice of Jesus should be the motivating factor for our tithing. A final word in closing. Over the next 3 weeks, we will dive even deeper into what the Bible teaches about the tithe, because we believe that giving and generosity are very important discipleship issues. As you consider what God is teaching you about money, possessions, and tithing, I want to share two final thoughts. First, what tithing isn't. It's not just casually throwing a few bills into the offering bucket every now and then. Tithing is so much more than this. Tithing is about recognizing that God is God over all of our money and possessions. It's an essential practice of all discipleship, and it's an acknowledgement of thanksgiving to God for giving us all that we have. We're praying that you will find the beauty in God's design for giving. Your project for this week is to prayerfully consider what the tithe is and what it looks like for you to be obedient to God with your money and possessions. I would encourage you today, if you have not already taken that step, take that step of faith by giving a tithe back to God. You can take this step today by visiting our Give page or texting MHGive to 41411.